Hello and welcome to the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast for the 29th of March 2015. My name's T.R.P. Watson, and this week I'm joined by Johnny Fox, Gareth James and Nick from Partially Obstructed View. We're now going to talk about Rules for Living, a new play by Sam Holcroft at the Dorfman Theatre. It is directed by Marion Elliott and has quite an interesting cast. Claudie Blakely, Deborah Finlay, Miles Jupp, Stephen Mangan, John Rogan, Maggie Service and Daisy Waterston. It appears to be set around Christmas, and I noticed that Marion Elliott did the Season's Greetings production at the National a few years ago, and I can't help feeling there may be some connections. Were there any, John?
Well, the first thing that struck me was, you know, three men, three women having a row in a kitchen. Oh, my God, how many times have we been here before with Alan Ayckbourn? And particularly with Stephen Mangan, who, of course, was in the revival of the Norman Conquests at the Old Vic, which is a sort of epitome of this kind of family conflict writ large on a domestic stage. And then I had to ask myself, well, you know, why is Sam Holcroft, who is a writer of enormous reputation already, even though she's quite young, taking this on and giving us what looks like an Ayckbourn, and what's she going to add to it, and will it actually increase the enjoyment or the fascination with the domestic subjects? And it took me quite a while whilst watching the piece to believe there was anything other than a slightly witty, quite well acted comedy set in a kitchen around Christmas, with all the tensions that families bring to that occasion and their interactions with each other. But it's the staging and the structure of the play, obviously, it's meant to mimic and parody those intense board games that you play, or charades that you play at Christmas. And what Holcroft has done is require each character to adopt a slightly ridiculous behavioural pattern in order to play this family game, which is the whole enactment of the play. So, for example, Stephen Mangan, playing the sort of eldest son, quite successful, quite charming, quite urban, quite witty, has to adopt ludicrous regional accents every time he wants to be sarcastic. Miles Jupp, who is the somewhat spoilt and self-indulgent mother's boy, the second son, has a character trait where he's actually secretly admiring of his brother's wife and needs to cover up the fact that he is often phoning her when he perhaps shouldn't be, when Stephen Mangan's character's out of the house and they have long, intimate conversations. And so his character trait that he has to observe in the game is he must sit down to tell a lie, or he must sit down and eat to tell a lie, because each one gets enhanced in a sort of second phase of the second round of the game. So that adds a piece of interest when it works. And it works when the characters like Mangan and Miles Jupp, who are very, very able, keep up the pretense and have the appearance of normality whilst demonstrating their character trait. But I think Sam Holcroft ran out of ideas, because the character played by Maggie Service is Miles Jupp's girlfriend, who is a slightly wacky, slightly not very good actress, who hasn't had very much work recently, and yet she has the kind of natural energy that you would associate with someone like Helen Lederer, you know, a loud, comedic, slightly clunking woman. And her rule is that, well, what she's trying to do is to calm herself down and appear much more marriageable and normal to Miles Jupp's family. So the balancing trait that she's given is that she must stand up and jig about every time she wants to tell a joke, which that doesn't work, I don't think, because it unbalanced the piece, because everyone else was carrying off their traits quite naturally. And in some cases, it so alters your perception of them. Claudie Blakely plays Stephen Mangan's wife, and they have together a young daughter, a younger teenage daughter, who is upstairs in bed because she has chronic fatigue syndrome. And she's a little bit like the absent Abigail in Abigail's Party. She's talked about a great deal, and you don't know that she's going to appear very late in the scene. And Blakely's character, she naturally displays all the neuroses that we associate with modern motherhood: over-concern, over-protection. She's a sort of Islington vegan-vegetarian character who is trying to be, you know, very restrained with everything that she puts into her body. And her character trait is that she must take a drink every time she wants to criticise or contradict somebody, which she likes to do quite a lot of the time. But that really, that sort of works. Although, again, it took me back to Ayckbourn, because, you know, the Sheila Hancock character in Absurd Person Singular, which is set in three successive Christmases in a kitchen, you know, also gets rat-arsed against her own will sort of thing. So I saw what they were doing, and I thought it almost worked. It doesn't stop it being very enjoyable. And as a nice, sharply written piece of satire, there's some very good lines, especially for Stephen Mangan and for Deborah Findlay playing his mother, which had a very, very good contribution to make. Mangan, my colleague who wrote the review for Londonist, because I saw it privately, said that he thought Stephen Mangan was just phoning in the performance. And I think you could say it's drawn very, very closely to the sarcastic characters he played in Green Wing or more recently in Episodes. And so maybe he didn't have to break sweat to deliver that character. So it's an enjoyable satire. It disintegrates is a better word, into an all-out farce with a food fight at the end, which designates the sort of breakdown of all the family relationships and how they come to repair it. But they are predicated on a piece of dramatic tension that is introduced in the character of the father of the piece. And I won't give it all away, but maybe Gareth will talk a little bit about that when he gives his analysis.
Gareth, what did you think?
I thought it had quite a lot more depths than I thought it was going to have, because it was billed as a comedy. I was kind of expecting, something as a straightforward comedy, but I actually think it's a lot more than that. And I think that the daughter, who isn't there very much until the end, as John said, is quite important to it, because she, with her condition, with her chronic fatigue condition, is about to undergo cognitive behavioral therapy. Cognitive behavioral therapy requires you to create rules for living. And in effect, what we're seeing, albeit in this kind of game way, because there is a kind of scoreboard where these rules are put up and in the second half actually scored. So in effect, what we're seeing these coping strategies of these characters. And I think that gives it a lot more depth, really. I think that the play does change in the second half. And I found the arrival of the father, who is in hospital, and the mother is kind of in denial, really, of how bad his illness is. And the father comes home for Christmas Day. And that sort of really makes the play take a bit of a tragicomic turn, because he comes back and everybody's shocked at how clearly how ill he is. And I think that changes it quite dramatically and makes it darker. But then we end up with this extraordinary food fight. It takes up quite a lot of time towards the end of the play. And then we get the arrival of the daughter who's unwell, and she turns out to be probably the sanest and the most normal of them all, really. So I found the play it was much more than a straightforward comedy. I thought it had much more depth than that. I thought the performances were very, very good. I particularly liked Deborah Findlay, who I thought was really excellent as the mother. But Claudia Bakeley, I thought, was outstanding. And I thought Miles Jupp also, although it was a bit of a Miles Jupp character, I thought Miles Jupp played that very well. I agree, I think, that Stephen Mangan was a little too much like Stephen Mangan. And I thought the Maggie Service, who played the actress, the Miles Jupp character's new girlfriend, was intentionally over the top, because she was meant to be a sort of bad actress, but it certainly was a performance that was over the top. So, I found myself laughing a lot, but I also found myself thinking a lot and thinking about my coping strategies and other people's coping strategies and kind of reflecting on my own dysfunctional family, really. So I enjoyed it very much. I thought it had a lot of originality about it, a very audacious production by Marianne Elliott with these scoreboards and this extraordinary sort of kitchen diner that we're sitting right around, and I was sitting right on the front row, right on top of this, and these big scoreboards high up above that. So a very, very enjoyable evening for me.
I thought it was very interesting that you, Gareth, went to it expecting it to be a comedy and then finding more, and I went to it expecting it to be more of a treatise on CBD and finding it was just a comedy. It was quite interesting.
I went to the last preview on last Monday, I think it was. That is interesting. Maybe it's because I got a dysfunctional family, John, therefore it was kind of
yesterday. Yeah, see, I buried all mine.
We're now going to talk about Stevie at the Hampstead Theatre. This is Hugh Whitemore's 1977 play about the poet Stevie Smith, who lived from 1902 to 1971. She was born in Kingston upon Hull, and she lived most of her life in Palmer's Green in North London, with her mother and her aunt, and in the later part of her life, just her aunt. This play tells a story, really, of that quiet life while she was becoming more and more famous and respected as a poet, and some of her difficulties struggling with this, either enjoying
the slight fame that she had. I think it was respect and a little bit of fame, but not massive fame that she had. In this play, we walk through her life. The play is directed by Christopher Morahan and stars Lynn Baron as the aunt, Zoe Wanamaker, Stevie Smith, and Chris Larkin as whatever man that needs to be said, whether it's an interviewer or a close personal friend or a boss or something like that. Whenever there needs to be a man for her to interact, it's going to be Chris Larkin in this. For me, this play is a biography told through the poet's works. Stevie keeps breaking into fragments of her poetry, and she does seem to be a very interesting poet, and her poems are, I thought, very, I keep wanting to say interesting, but it's a good, gentle kind of poetry, and often very affecting. But she doesn't seem to be that well known now. This play was previously filmed with Glenda Jackson in the starring role back in, 1978. Gareth, tell me more about this and what you thought of it.
Well, Glenda Jackson wasn't just in the film. She actually was the first Stevie on stage as well. And now she's the MP for the part of London where the revival is being staged, which is an interesting change. I actually saw this play a long time ago, and I'm not going to say how long ago, but I didn't see the original London production because I was living in Bristol, and I saw a Bristol Old Vic production with a wonderful actress called June Barry. And at the time, you know, my recollection is that I was kind of captivated by this biographical play, and it was one of the first things I saw, really, because I was quite sort of late to theatre in my 20s. And I kind of was therefore really looking forward to going to see it, particularly as it has Zoe Wanamaker in it. And I sort of left rather disappointed. And I think the reason for that is that, unlike so many revivals we've seen lately that have proved plays to be classics and have been, if anything, better than the original productions, I'm afraid this one has not worn well with age, really. And I think it's kind of faded perhaps with Stevie Smith's legacy itself, because I don't think as a poet she's talked about or thought about that much today anyway, sadly. And I kind of wondered, you know, why did he write this play? Because she was a fairly minor poet and frankly a fairly ordinary life, really. So maybe at the time I was as captivated by the performance of June Barry as I was this time by the performance of Zoe Wanamaker, rather than the work itself, because I think the work itself is, you know, it's a biographical piece, as you say. I think it's really a monologue where she's telling her own life story and it's interspersed with her poems. And then the monologue's interrupted occasionally by this beloved aunt of hers and some of the men in her life. And I just think as a play, it just seemed really very dull to me now, I'm afraid. Zoe Wanamaker is terrific. You know, she transformed herself with sort of frumpy frocks and this kind of schoolgirl hair. And she talks to the audience a lot and does engage you. You know, she scans the audience quite a bit and makes a lot of eye contact. And I think that kind of does draw you into the character, but it's not enough for me. She's only got, as you say, she's only got Lynda Baron, who is great as her aunt, and then Chris Larkin, who plays these other men, these are extras to her life story, if you like, very well. And he also acts as a bit of a narrator. And then you've got this amazing set by Simon Higlett, where he's kind of created this huge period Palmer's Green living room with the most extraordinary detail. And it kind of becomes a bit expressionistic in the sort of top left-hand corner as it appears to sort of morph into the trees that are behind it. But I kind of wondered, you know, what a lot of trouble, a lot of expense to go to for a play that actually doesn't use it as such, because it's actually quite a static play. It doesn't kind of use this superb creation, really. I think there are better Hugh Whitmore plays, and it would be nice to see Breaking the Code, his play about Alan Turing, I think, in particular, because I think that would be timely, I think, to do that now. And I just kind of wondered whether the form of this play had just kind of had its day, really. The night I went, there were quite a lot of school kids in the front row, and because the auditorium is kind of arched, they're actually sort of slightly to the sides and therefore very close to the action. And they were clearly having not a good time at all. And I'm sure that was very distracting to Zoe Wanamaker, because it was certainly very distracting to me, because they were kind of making faces at each other across the auditorium and fidgeting and whatever. So, I mean, I kind of, even though they distracted me, I kind of felt a little bit like them, really. I just thought it was just a little bit dull. And the main reason for going to see it was this great central performance by Zoe Wanamaker. And the set, I guess, if you're into sets. But it's a play that's had its day, I think.
Yeah, I suppose I did find it a little bit old-fashioned. He is certainly a playwright I've liked in the few things I've seen of his, and I too would like to see Breaking the Code. It's one of those plays that when I first moved down to London, I think it was on, and I never got round to seeing it for whatever reason, and I always quite regret that, because apparently it was a really stand-up performance by Derek Jacobi.
Yes, it was. I saw it. It was very, very good, although people say that the film, which I don't think I have seen, didn't do it justice, but certainly on stage it was very, very good. But he is, I mean, he does, I think almost everything he does is kind of biographical. And I think a lot of actors are drawn to his work. You know, he's had people like Derek Jacobi and I think Judi Dench and loads of others actually perform his plays. I think people are very drawn to his theatrical language, really.
We're now going to talk about The Royale by Marco Ramirez. This is a play at the Bush Theatre, directed by Madani Yunus. It is, I suppose, a slightly fictionalised account of the famous heavyweight boxer Jack Johnson. Although, in this case, the boxer is called Jay the Sport Jackson. Jack Johnson was a famous boxer towards the turn of the century who, to a certain extent, broke the segregation. Because he was such a great boxer, they had to put a so-called Great White Hope against him. And that was, I think, covered in a film called The Great White Hope with James Earl Jones in the title role as Jack Johnson. But this play, of course, as I say, is fictionalised and really deals with the experience of a different boxer, but a boxer who is a shadow, shall we say, of the original, so that the playwright can write his own story. Gareth, tell me more about this and what you thought of it.
Well, I go to the Bush a lot, but I didn't book for this because I thought, well, this is a play about boxing and I don't really like boxing, so I didn't book to go and see it. And then picked up on the fact it wasn't really a play about boxing, not only a play about boxing, and indeed the reviews were really good. So I kind of fortunately woke up soon enough and got myself a ticket before I suspected sold out now. And as you say, it's inspired by the life of Jack Johnson, although the playwright goes to a lot of lengths to say this isn't the life of Jack Johnson. And it's quite a short play, it's just 90 minutes without interval, but it's very, very gripping. It's a very gripping, intense drama and has five absolutely stunning performances. And the whole kind of production for me oozes authenticity, really. As you say, our fictional boxer is already black heavyweight world boxing champion. So we're in a segregation period now. So he's the black heavyweight champion. And he kind of tours the US with his trainer, Winton, and a white boxing promoter, Max, fighting other black boxers. And then one of them, an amateur called Fish, he asked to be his sparring partner. So he kind of comes with him as his sparring partner for the rest of his touring. And the promoter, who's also the referee, Max, tries to set up a match with the white world heavyweight boxing champion and struggles very much to do that. But eventually he manages to set up what is unthinkable, but he has to give away an enormous chunk of the purse, whether the other guy wins or loses, which some perceive as an insult to Jay. But Jay himself sort of decides, well, he doesn't care. He wants to go ahead and have this match regardless. The play turns then a bit because his big sister turns up and we begin to understand the origin of his motivation for this battle. But we also begin to understand the potential consequences of the battle, which are quite frightening in race relations terms. And in effect, you know, he could be having a dramatic effect on society, but at the same time, he also could be putting many lives at risk. This is played out kind of on a boxing ring, although it's really just a sort of platform because there are no ropes there. And it's very impressionistic, so there's no, you know, no blows landed, as it were, but it still has the most extraordinary intensity. And apart from the acting, I mean, there's brilliant lighting from, I think, James Whiteside. And there's also fantastic movement. I don't know how else you can describe it, really, but the movement is very dramatic, but also sort of very elegant as well. I mean, the five performances for me were just, you know, just fantastic. And sitting there on the edge of the rink, you know, you really see them close up. And, you know, the intensity of the acting was just marvelous. I mean, not just the two boxers, Nicholas Pinnock and a guy called Gershwin Eustace Jr., who are exceptional. But, you know, even Ewan Stewart as the promoter, Max, I've seen him a lot, but he's done nothing better than this. I think he's excellent in this. And then Clint Dyer, an actor I've also seen quite a bit, you know, giving a terrific performance as Jay's trainer. And then when we eventually get to see Nina, which is quite late into the play, Frances Ashman just gives this incredibly moving performance as his sister and becomes absolutely pivotal to the play for the rest of it. So I just found this a very, very, very well-written play, but also, you know, getting a production that absolutely, I'm sure, couldn't be bettered. And with this boxing ring and men seating on four sides in a kind of, you know, in an intimate setting that just means you sort of take in every movement, every word. And I was gripped from beginning to end, and I left the theatre absolutely on a high. I thought, wow, you know, this is why I go to the theatre. So thank goodness I realised it wasn't just about boxing, because it's something I don't like or even approve of. It was a whole lot more than that. And I think we'll be in our list of best plays this year. That's my view anyway.
I have to say that, because I know that you've been rather down on the Bush Theatre recently, and I have to say, coming out of it, I didn't know whether or not you'd been, and I thought, well, you would certainly be certainly something to point out to you, because I thought you would enjoy it. It was a very, very well-performed and well-put-together play. And as you say, the way they do the boxing is very clever and very impressionistic, but you do get that, you still get that feeling of how they're doing in the ring at the time when there are these few boxing matches. But it is also about the idea of segregation and that idea that we fortunately don't hear the word, but the uppity N-word that used to be bandied around and was, I think, still bandied around occasionally by people in when I was very young, but fortunately I think has kind of died out, because, you know, it's sort of the idea that black people had a place and they had to stick to it, and it was always going to be under the thumb of the white person, which is part of one of the major themes of this play. And I just, that sort of thing makes me feel uncomfortable and almost grateful that it's gone away to a certain extent. I mean, there's, you know, we can always point out places where it hasn't. And in some ways, it did shock me to be reminded of the way people used to behave. You know, you weren't allowed to put your head above the parapet if you were black. It is a reminder. I mean, there's an awful lot going on in this play, and that's just a minor part of it. And I was very impressed by it and very glad I saw it. It's nice to see something at the Bush that's a really sort of great play, I think.
It'd be wonderful if it had a life beyond the Bush. I mean, it'd be difficult to stage in any other way, I think. I think it needs this kind of staging. But, you know, it'd be wonderful if it got another run or went somewhere else, although I know that some of these actors are very sought after. I think Nicholas Pinnock has a lot of television work, film work, so maybe it can't happen. But it'd be great if maybe something, you know, like a live relay would be fantastic, because I think it really needs to be seen by a hell of a lot more people than are going to see it in the months of the Bush.
We're now going to talk about Radiant Vermin by Philip Ridley. This is his new play on at the Soho Theatre, directed by David Mercatali and starring Gemma Whelan, Sean Michael Vary and Amanda Daniels. I think Philip Ridley is one of those must-see playwrights. Nick, tell me more about this and what you thought of it.
Well, he's certainly a must-see playwright for me, and I'd been looking forward to this for a long time, and it kind of lived up to my expectations, and then some. So that's, you know, as good a recommendation as I could give to anything, to be honest, because I've not been kind of blown away by stuff for a while, for a couple of months. There's not been anything new coming along that's really blown me away, so I was starting to feel a bit like I was getting a bit jaded, and then this came along and just is just absolutely spectacular. What it is, it's, I suppose, in theory, it fits in with things like Game and Deposit, which is satires on the housing crisis, and also kind of features a young couple who have to do something pretty extreme in return for somewhere to live. Obviously, being Philip Ridley, it does so in a very kind of dark fairy tale sort of way, absolutely twisted way that I really don't want to describe, because I think, you know, I strongly recommend people see it, and I think the less you know going in about exactly what the story is, the better. But suffice it to say, it's pretty outrageous and pretty horrific. But it's done in, I've always found, I mean, not in every one of his works, but I've always found more humour in Ridley than people necessarily credit him for. But with this, I think it's probably the first time, certainly in his plays for adults, that he's written an out-and-out comedy. And it's, although there's a couple of really kind of sinister appearances by Amanda Daniels, the vast majority of the play is carried by Gemma Whelan and Sean Michael Verry, who play this sort of young couple in their 20s. They're expecting a baby. They live somewhere pretty grim and notoriously dangerous estate and are offered by this Mephistophelian kind of character played by Amanda Daniels, who offers them this house. It's in a pretty bad state of repair, but it's a solid house. And the deal is that they repair it, basically, and then they can have it for free on that basis, and they do the repairs. And the twist really is in what dark magic is involved in restoring each room. But it's done in a very sort of vaudeville comedy kind of way. They're done as kind of a really enthusiastic double act, and they play them very much kind of... There's a really nicely done contrast between the dark story they're telling and the kind of cheerful, happy way that they're presented, the characters. They're very kind of 70s sitcom couple. There's definitely a sort of Michael Crawford influence in the way Sean Verry plays Ollie. And it's just very, very funny. It's a couple of people have said that it's a bit kind of blatant with its metaphor. I think, to be honest, Ridley's usually so oblique that it's quite a nice, refreshing change to be able to absolutely pinpoint exactly what he's satirizing at every point. And to be honest, it's kind of, it's very clear what the satire is, but it's kind of never stops everything from being just very funny. And it's just such an energetic performance from the two of them. The website kind of notes on it make a lot of reference to the fact that everybody involved in it has worked with Philip Ridley before. All the actors have been in his shows before. And obviously, David McAtaley is one of the most prolific directors of Ridley's work. And I think that is relevant, really, because I think with, in a way, making a bit of a departure from the sort of thing he writes and also making really quite major demands on his cast, I think there's nobody who sees this who doesn't kind of remember the kind of climactic, I think they call it the birthday party from bloody hell. It's just an absolutely incredible performance from Gemma Whelan and Sean Verry. But throughout, to be honest, even before it kind of climaxes in that, it's just so impressive. There's not a lot of shows that I feel desperate to see again. This one, I was, within 20 minutes, I was already figuring out how to get to see it again, because I did not want to miss the chance to see it again before it closes. It's hugely recommended from me. I mean, this for me, this is the show to beat this year for Show of the Year.
Yeah, I was very impressed by it. And I certainly noticed the Some Mothers Do have some connections. I mean, it's not just Sean Michael Verry's performance, which is slightly fey and does remind you a lot of Michael Crawford. It's also Gemma Whelan's performance as Jill. She's very much like Michelle Dotrice in some ways, and I felt the connection. It's almost as if someone has given Philip Ridley the box set of Some Of Us Do Have Them for Christmas. Also, to complain really about the play hitting you over the head with all its theme about, you know, the housing crisis and difficulty of housing. There's a wonderful phrase that I once heard from Stephen Fry, which is, it's like complaining that 101 Dalmatians has too many dogs in it. It's there, it's obvious, but you don't mind because everything else is going on is so much more interesting and so much more fun. I mean, certainly that the birthday party from hell is extremely well done, but so is everything else. And you do get a slight break from the comedy with a very touching scene with one of their, I think they talk about their redecorators, I think, who help them with their renovation of their house.
Yeah, the renovators, although without giving too much away, I don't know if, I'm not convinced that is a different character. I think I think, again, that's sort of one of the interesting things about it. There are little things in there that are open to interpretation. And I think one of them is, you know, I don't think that is a different character. I think that's the same character. I have to say this without massively spoilering, trying to kind of push them along, because there's certain things of kind of, there's something she says where there's a way it kind of pans out that makes sort of everything all right And I think that's kind of what's going on there. Is I think it's someone in disguise, that scene. But yes.
I mean, it's certainly a touching scene, however we interpret it, I think. I was very surprised. I mean, I'm always looking forward to seeing the new Philip Ridley play, but this was something of a surprise. I mean, it is something of a departure from what he's done before. I mean, he's not really done out-and-out comedy for adults before. I mean, I agree with you when you say he's always a little bit more funny and a little bit more satirical, if you allow him to be. I mean, you can paint him as very dark and bloody, but if you do that too much, you become aware that he sometimes pulls his punches and things aren't quite as bad. There's often quite a lot of hope in his plays, if you allow it, and I think if you take it as a very dark play, and if you take his other plays as very dark, they don't work quite as well. There has to be that sort of slightly heightened feeling and that idea that there's something, a little bit of a sense of humour in it.
Okay. I think Shivered is one that I found, I saw it a lot more that way than many people seem to. You know, I think a lot of people found it kind of incredibly dark, and I really thought it had a lot more light and shade to it. But obviously this is really taking it to a different level.
And also the last thing Gemma Whelan was in, I'm not sure, Dark Vanilla Jungle, I'm not sure that could be taken as fun play.
No, but to be honest, it's not one it's probably one of my least favourite of his plays. I wasn't crazy about it. I thought she was amazing in it, but I didn't love the play. I was glad that this was one where I loved both the performances and the play.
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the As Yet Unnamed London Theatre Podcast page in Facebook. On the web, we are AYULTP.com. And the podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you. Goodbye.